Professor Romberg, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to quickly address three topics. First, whether there was consent and what role it played. Second, the regulations about criminal background checks and the role that plays in this case and going forward. And third, the role of implicit bias in under Batson and Gilmore and under rules, which we urge this court to look into. So first, as to consent, one thing that hasn't been discussed is that Gilmore defines the timing when consent is relevant, when objection has to be made. So Gilmore at 535 specifically says that defendant must timely object during or at the end of the jury selection, but before the petty jury is sworn. In fact, that's what happened in Gilmore, is that the peremptory had already been issued. And then much later at the end of jury selection, but before the jury was sworn, objection was made. And here, as the appellate division, page 12 of its opinion pointed out, that after the court took a break, defense counsel said she'd had the opportunity to speak with her office, and she withdrew her consent to the dismissal of FG for cause. And after that point, and before, while FG was still seated, and before he was even arrested or dismissed, she said, quote, what the state did do was selectively target one potential juror and look up information about that potential juror. They targeted that juror. I think it implicates due process concerns. It implicates constitutional concerns regarding that person's rights to sit on a jury. And some of your honors have suggested, well, maybe there was unconstitutional conduct as to FG, but that doesn't really relate to Andujar. FG is not the plaintiff here. But as this court made plain in Gilmore, part of the constitutional right under our constitution is to have a jury representing a cross section of the community. And that implicates not only the defendant's right to have an impartial jury, but the juror's right to serve is specifically recognized. And moreover, public confidence in the impartiality of the jury is also part of that right. And because the juror, him or herself, has no realistic opportunity or incentive to assert that right, to get injunctive relief, they can't retroactively be put on the jury, they can't get money, it makes sense that it's the criminal defendant who has standing to assert that juror's constitutional right. So even if FG's constitutional rights were infringed, even if Andujar's weren't, or even if this court thought that there was consent as to Andujar, the defense counsel specifically retracted that consent before FG was dismissed in line with Gilmore, and specifically, at the very least, specifically raised FG's constitutional right, which Andujar himself can represent.
Professor, if you can, what part of the transcript are you relying on for the retraction of consent?
I'm looking, I don't have the transcript. The appellate division, I believe at page 12, specifically says the court took a short break, after which defense counsel said that she had the opportunity to speak with her office and she withdrew her consent to the dismissal of FG for cause.
Yeah, so I'm looking at that part of the transcript, which culminates with the court confirming that the only remedy being sought is an extra challenge. I was looking for more precise language, but we'll continue to comb it ourselves, I suppose. Go ahead.
Right. So I don't know exactly what she said. I think it made it clear that she made it clear that she thought there was a constitutional concern. And my take is that if she hadn't done that, there would be a question.
Professor, does the defense counsel have an obligation of at least suggesting remedy? Because I do have the transcript, this is the chief does. I'm looking at page 67, and she does place on the record her concern about singling out this particular juror for a check of warrants. But then it says, I don't know what the remedy is for that. And then later does not ask that the juror be seated, but just says, hey, I'd like to have an extra peremptory challenge. I mean, is that a sufficient basis for creating an objection to the actual array?
Go ahead. Yes, Justice Albin, it is. Saying, I think there's a constitutional problem here, I'm not sure what the remedy is sufficient to raise the issue and to put it before the court. And obviously the question of the proper remedy is complicated. I think the proper remedy here, the state says, well, even if the background check was improper, it's not a problem because then it goes to the judge to get screened. But there are a couple of problems with that. One is, if the background check should never have been conducted in the first place, even let's say it revealed that there was a disqualifying conviction, which didn't happen, or let's assume that it resulted in showing that FG shouldn't have been seated. The problem is, if that background check never should have been conducted, then you have a tainted veneer. And the proper remedy, if you look at Andrews and other cases, the proper remedy is to dismiss that panel, because the obviously, if a juror couldn't be seated, then they shouldn't be seated. But if the determination that they couldn't have been seated arose from an improper and selective check, then the remedy is to dismiss that panel.
Okay, so take that. Let's say the background check brought forth a disqualifying conviction. Person was convicted of a crime. Your position is the improper background check now requires the disqualification. This objective information that requires this disqualification of that juror requires now the disqualification of the entire jury. Is that your position?
I wouldn't frame it that way, but yes, obviously, if a juror is not qualified, that juror can't serve. But if the determination that the juror wasn't qualified was made in an unlawful way, then the proper remedy, and this has come up in prior cases, the remedy is to dismiss that panel. And the state says that there's no problem because the judge will always screen and determine whether a for cause or a peremptory challenge is valid. The problem is, and the Supreme Court of the United States and Flowers recognize this, that if there's a selective focus on a particular subset of potential jurors, then, you know, you may, if you go on a fishing expedition, you may come up with a basis to exclude a subset of them. And that's why it's improper to allow selectively the prosecution without judicial oversight to determine whom it's going to run a background check on.
And should the court in a situation like the one you're describing override the request, the specific request of counsel? Because in this case, and I'll read for you from page 73, the court, the only remedy you've requested is to be afforded an extra challenge. Is that correct, defense attorney? That is correct.
The defense counsel raised the problem, said she wasn't sure of the proper remedy. It's true that she suggested one remedy, but the court has an independent obligation to apply Gilmore, particularly when that's raised to the court. And even if it hadn't been raised to the court, it would be a question of abuse of discretion for failure to, just like the question of competency, which the court would have an obligation to recognize sua sponte, or would be subject to abuse of discretion for review for not recognizing. Similarly, even if it hadn't been raised, the trial court would have to assess it. But it was raised here, and the fact that defense counsel, in a very complicated question, only thought of one remedy and perhaps saw the writing on the wall.
So, Professor, it really isn't so complicated. Yeah. I mean, the defense attorney could have requested and should have requested that the juror be brought before the court and that there be questioning. The first question would be is whether or not the record even related the nature of the charge, whether or not the warrant could be resolved. I'm not saying that the court may not have had an independent obligation, but certainly the defense counsel is the first line of defense representing the client. No?
Yes. And ideally, the defense counsel would have raised these arguments.
Do you at least concede that the manner in which, and I'll just put quotation marks around the objection, was totally deficient on the part of defense counsel?
I would say it's not totally deficient. I would say that you may not be surprised to hear. I would say that it was not ideal, but the question of the constitutionality of removing FG for cause was put before the court without deep exploration of the potential remedy. I would say that it's very difficult, and it's not also something that hasn't been pointed out. It's not fair to penalize defense counsel here for not recognizing the non-obvious proposition that a background check resulting in a for-cause dismissal would be subject to Batson and Gilmore. The state has conceded that that's true here and has conceded that Gilmore encompasses implicit bias. But I think suggesting that defense counsel, who said, "I do not consent, I think there's a constitutional problem, I'm not sure what the remedy is," to suggest that she should have explicitly invoked Gilmore when it was not obvious it would apply in this context, and to suggest that her lack of her, the fact she didn't come up with a perfect remedy means the argument is waived, I think is not the right approach.
So the record is a little bit more complicated and you don't have the transcript, so we need not spend much more time on it, but there was a break, she went back to the office, she consulted with individuals, she came back, she then, having spent more time thinking about it, presented the remedy that she requested. The record is what it is. Why don't we move on to the regulations?
So then the question is, under the regulations, there are two sets of questions. One, what do the regulations themselves authorize? And two, what does this court, would this court approve, even if the regulations purported to authorize what happened here? Quickly, on the first question, which we go into in our brief, we do not think that the purpose here was the administration of criminal justice. And even the AG's position is that criminal background checks should be used extremely rarely, and only when there's a strong basis to believe that the prospective juror is being untruthful, either about the qualification for having been convicted of an indictable offense or having lied in voir dire. And that plainly is not met here. The fact that he had some relatives and friends who'd been involved in the criminal justice system is even setting aside whether there's implicit bias, it's plainly not sufficient under the AG's proposed standard to justify a background check, which, as we argued, should be both pre and post impanelment subject to judicial approval, both because we don't think that the regulations authorize it, as happened here, and even if they purported to, that should be within the control of the judiciary, both in interpreting the Constitution and in the court's power to manage the judicial process and the jury selection process, and that all these requests should be put before a judge, as Justice Solomon suggested. Notice is certainly helpful. It allows for a Batson-Gilmore inquiry raised by defense counsel or recognized by the court. It should be approved under terms similar to what the AG proposes, but without the distinction between pre and post impanelment. The reason why pre impanelment is improper is two reasons. One, as I mentioned before, that if there's a selective assessment as to a subset of jurors, even if sometimes you come up with something that allows for a just basis for excluding someone, that doesn't mean the process is fair. And as the Chief Justice pointed out, also self-policing, as the state points out, suggests, is not going to be effective with implicit bias. That, in fact, exactly what happened in this case is you don't have someone, you have someone who's trying to do the right thing. And in my opinion, the judgment was influenced by implicit bias about what can one can assume about whether the FG had convictions or was lying because of his associations and knowledge of fairly common lingo. Doesn't mean someone is an overt conscious racist who's going to be aware of that. It means it's a problem. It should be subject to judicial review for under Gilmore, including implicit bias, and that it meets the rare criteria the AG points out. Something else to note in terms of the regulations is that if used for a criminal justice purpose, the regulations specifically say they can't be, they can only be used for the purpose for which they were investigated. They can't be used for any other purpose or disseminated here. So if the purported purpose was to ensure an impartial jury, then passing it along to law enforcement to arrest FG was not authorized by the background check here, and instead is deeply problematic in terms of undermining the administration of justice and should simply never occur. That someone should be arrested after showing up for jury service, even under the current regulations as they exist, it's prohibited, and is another reason why the conviction here should not stand. Finally, as to the role of implicit bias, the state recognizes that Gilmore, even if not Batson, but Gilmore should take into account implicit bias. It's going to be difficult to determine. Here we have what I think on this record is compelling evidence of what was motivating the state, which I think doesn't even establish a legitimate basis untainted by implicit bias. I don't think the court needs to get to step three here. Again, not that anyone is evil. The prosecutor is motivated to do the right thing, But I think it's plain looking at this overt record that implicit bias drove the decision here. And respectfully, I'd suggest that this court, what I was suggesting is that here, the problem of implicit bias, maybe this is an unusual case, I think is apparent on this record. And if this court doesn't resolve the case through the question of the propriety of the background check, the question of implicit bias under Batson and in particular under Gilmore, I think is quite apparent here. We'd urge this court to look closely at the Washington state's decisions implementing under the state constitution the principles of Batson, but more rigorously in St. Cali and Jefferson, in particular, taking into account implicit bias and what an objective observer would perceive, and also convening a task force or commission looking into the sorts of rules that should be applied in the future, as Washington did under Rule 37, because it would be far preferable for these kinds of problems to be stopped at the front end, rather than through litigation in cases like this, rather than through a retrospective Gilmore analysis. If you have rules up front, then you don't have problems like defense counsel here expressly raising racial bias in an apparent in-chambers discussion before the judge, at which the prosecutor took umbrage and said, "How dare you accuse me of being a racist?" And understandably, the defense counsel backed off of that, which is maybe why you had the temporary consent. If you have rules up front that say the kinds of assumptions that the prosecutors employed here are simply not permissible, then you don't have this kind of problem. You don't have the problem of judges also being reluctant to label prosecutors as engaged in even implicitly biased racist behavior.
Professor, you heard the question I asked of Mr. Brown. So I know we're talking about investigation tools being used here, but the use of peremptory challenge, it seems, is the greatest cover for implicit and also explicit bias, whether it's being exercised by the prosecution or the defense. Would you agree with that notion? And that Gilmore and Batson, although they are remedies, they're probably not up to the task of completely exposing those types of biases that are used in peremptory challenges.
I would agree that Gilmore, even made more robust, as I would urge this court to do, and as the state has conceded, reaches implicit bias, and also takes into account the objective observer effect, I would agree it's an imperfect remedy. I would say as to whether eliminating peremptory challenges is the appropriate response, I would defer to my colleagues in the public defender's office, in the ACDL, that how to deal with the jury selection process might well be addressed in a task force which considers implementing something like Rule 37. I don't have enough experience in the heart of the trial courts to have an informed opinion about that. But what I would urge this court to do is to recognize the very real problem here was that there was not a representative cross-section of the community. The problem was put before the judge, admittedly without a remedy, a specific remedy, but the problem was put before the judge. I would suggest that it could have been remedied at the time, and it should be remedied at this point.
Professor, are you familiar with some of the literature that Justice Albin was alluding to that is critical of peremptories for the reasons he offered?
Yes.
And if that's so, how are more peremptories better?
Again, I'm not arguing for more peremptories. And in fact, I'm arguing to restrain both sides' use of peremptories insofar as they violate a more rigorous implementation of Gilmore. So I recognize Justice Marshall and others, some scholars have suggested that the only way to remedy the problem of implicit bias is through clamping down on peremptories. as I said, I don't have enough experience in criminal trials to have an informed opinion or even a deeply informed scholarly opinion about whether that's the way to go. I do think perhaps that issue, and certainly whether this state should adopt rules parallel to Rule 37, is something that this court should take up.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Mr. Dakota.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So in response to your question, Chief, before I get to a few things I'd like to respond to, our understanding is that background checks of prospective jurors or sitting jurors is extremely rare. I know the Attorney General represented that as well on page 18 of his brief. It is not something that comes up a lot. It is a rare occurrence. So I think any kind of argument that this is something that prosecutors are abusing, I think is unfounded, you know, to the extent that argument was made or alluded to. If there was widespread abuse, I would imagine by now this court or the appellate division would have seen it by now. So I'd just like to respond to a few things. And
you know, some of these slides, Mr. Dakota, if I could follow up,
sure.
Does that also suggest that there is not a substantial need for the state to be able to conduct background checks on its own based on what you've just shared with us?
No, I think what it means is in most cases, there's not a reason to do it. You know, the prospective jurors do not give prosecutors or the court or defense attorneys reason to believe that a background check might be necessary. But I think in some cases it is very necessary, and it's not something that should be taken away because it's not used often.
Let me rephrase that.
Go ahead. So if it's something that does not happen often, what is the harm in requiring the state to go before the court to require to get authority in order to conduct such a background check? If it's not something that happens often, it's not going to clog the system, it's not going to slow down the process. Why is that an issue?
Our argument has never been that it would slow down the process. The argument is that starting from the supposition that the state needs to clear this with the trial court, I don't see a basis for that presumption.
Well, the trial court is in charge of the jury selection process, correct? So the argument is at the point at which jury selection has begun and you've received this information of the names, the list of the potential jurors, why would it be an issue to go before the court and request permission and authority to run the check?
I mean, practically, it's not an issue, to be honest with you. I don't think it would, you know, clog the courts, and I don't have a problem necessarily giving the court notice that that's what we're going to be doing. I don't see a need for requiring preclearance on behalf of prosecutors, that's all. So a couple things I wanted to respond to that I heard. There was this argument that the prosecutor didn't care, that the victims, that, you know, FG knew people who were victims who were murdered in incidents of domestic violence. And I would point this court to 3T94, where before any of the other things we've talked about or even discussed, the prosecutor said, I think on a case like this, he has had two cousins that were murdered. One was involved in a stabbing and a domestic dispute. It mirrors the facts of this case. It is a risk to take a chance on somebody that might have a problem with his cousin getting murdered. So that was part of the concern. So we shouldn't act like it was completely irrelevant.
If that's all there was, would that be a for-cause challenge?
I think there would be a basis for a for-cause challenge there, sure.
Well, he made a for-cause challenge and it was turned down. The prosecutors made as a result of the questioning, there was a for-cause challenge. It was turned down by the court, and then the prosecutors went to their offices and conducted the background check. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
Okay.
One of the things that came up too was about this notion of, you know, fleeting consent or a quick consent. I just want to, and Justice Fernandez-Vina, you asked a great question. Well, who decides whether someone consented or not? And the trial court, of course, makes that call. And in this case, the trial court did make that call. at 5T 141.17, Judge Raven found that the defense consented. So to the extent that was, there's some kind of dispute about whether it was consent, I think the trial court answered that question. One of the amici also made a point of, well, what happens if the prosecutor runs 6 background checks and they don't reveal anything? Well, the problem with that is it rests on the assumption that we're not going to turn over those results. And that's completely contrary to what we did here and completely contrary to our position before this court, as well as before the appellate division. When you run a criminal background check, that's something that there is a paper trail of. You can see who looked for it, when they looked for it. So there is a record of that being done. So to the extent this court might be concerned that prosecutors would abuse that or do so, in the darkness, that's just not supported by the way criminal record checks are conducted.
Mr. Ducote, would you be comfortable, would you think it a fair system if only defense attorneys had the right to run these background checks of their own choosing and then turn it over, and the prosecution did not have the ability and would have to go to a judge instead?
No, I don't think that would be fair for either side. I think both parties should be allowed to use background checks and to bring the information they find before the court and allow the court to ultimately make the call. That's why our position, does not usurp the authority of the courts in jury selection. It supplements it. It gives the court more information to decide questions about whether jurors are fit to serve. Another point was that the trial attorney, the defense attorney, immediately brought up race as being an issue. But I think it's important to know that the attorney immediately took that comment back. And so to the extent it's been argued that the prosecutor was circumventing a Batson or a Gilmore challenge, there'd be nothing to circumvent if the last position from defense counsel was that this was not a race-based, not race-based conduct by the prosecutor. So, that was mentioned and then it was immediately taken back. So I don't follow the circumventing Batson argument at all.
Well, Mr. Ducote, as Professor Romberg argued, when the defense attorney made that statement with regard to the fact that if this is an appropriate basis, no Black man in Newark would ever be able to serve on a jury, the prosecutor did take offense to that. And that's when the defense attorney retracted that statement. Isn't that an accurate reading of the record?
Well, of course the prosecutor took offense to that argument. That in and of itself is an offensive argument. The prosecutor had every right to take umbrage to that. And I don't know of too many defense trial attorneys that are worried about the feelings of prosecutors when they're representing their clients. If the defendant thinks Batson is violated, then I don't think the attorney cares whether he or she is going to hurt the prosecutor's feelings. They're going to raise that objection in the interest of their clients, and we would expect nothing less from them. So I think the fact that she took it back was not her not wanting to hurt the prosecutor's feelings. I think she took it back because she immediately realized that she was incorrect. One of the amici also essentially conceded that it's okay we ask prospective jurors these questions about whether they've been accused of crimes, whether they've been convicted of crimes, but then the problem seems to be the ability to verify those answers. I don't see how we can, I don't think we should go in not believing jurors what they say. We should believe what they say, but I don't think we should be precluded from ensuring that they are being honest and candid with the court. Another thing is there was talk about, the things that were before the trial court turned out not to be true. There's really no proof of that. The defense attorney received the incident reports. She was aware of the warrant. The prosecutor made representations as to what those incident reports said. Defense counsel did not dispute those. The judge did not accuse the prosecutor of mischaracterizing what happened in those prior incidents. So, to the extent there is disagreement as to the record, I think the record is pretty clear that the prosecutor's allegations as to what had happened with FG in the past is corroborated by the record. And then the very last thing, because remedy has come up in a couple different contexts, I just want to say first that to the extent people have argued, my friends have argued that the judge didn't consider remedies. Well, courts don't consider remedies until there's an objection and an objection is sustained. Courts don't just impose remedies on conduct that doesn't violate the Constitution, that doesn't violate the court rules. They're not in the business of imposing remedies when there's nothing to remedy. The second point about remedy is there are no cases that hold that even a prima facie case under Batson entitles defendant to a new trial. You know, this court said in Thompson a couple of years ago that that is an extreme remedy. And even in that case, where the prima facie case was striking 7 out of 9 African-American jurors, clearly a prima facie case, the court ultimately held following a full Batson hearing that discrimination had not occurred. So a prima facie case does not result in a new trial. And then finally, to the extent this court modifies or interprets the rule about when prosecutors can do background checks under the code, there are no cases that hold defendants are entitled to new trials based on violations of the administrative code that had never been interpreted before. So to the extent this court announces a new rule about when and under what circumstances and under what procedures the state may run a background check, we would ask that that ruling be purely prospective. It has nothing to do with the truth-seeking function or the validity of the verdict against Mr. Andujar. So we would ask that the conviction be reinstated and then any rule be purely prospective.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you to all counsel for the fine presentations.